The peace of wild things. When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water, and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free.
How to survive the end of the world. Get to know your neighbors. Feed them. Let them feed you. Watch each other's kids, grandkids, pets. Develop the muscle of generosity, like you are training for a giving ultramarathon. Share everything you can with anyone who asks, and ask for what you need. Get in touch with your body. You will need it, and it knows things. Pay attention to what is happening below your neck. Tell the truth. Tell it to yourself first. Sit at the feet of your most vulnerable neighbors in your own most vulnerable places. They have the most to teach you about survival. Listen. Remember your ancestors and the things they survived. Find the resilience that is your birthright and the courage that made way for your life. Practice taking risk. Show up in every struggle where someone is fighting for their dignity, because that is how we will all survive. Learn about reparations and native sovereignty. Double down on exercising supremacy systems from your soul. Learn to be tender. Refuse to be hardened. Let your heart be moved every damn time. Root in the place you are. Learn its history. Learn its geography. Learn its seasons. Sing a lot. And dance. Make art. Make love. Rest luxuriously. Eat pie. There is a brokenness. There is a brokenness out of which comes the unbroken. A shatteredness out of which blooms the unshatterable. There is a sorrow beyond all grief which leads to joy. And a fragility out of whose depths emerges strength. There is a hollow space too vast for words, through which we pass with each loss, out of whose darkness We are sanctified into being. There is a cry deeper than all sound, whose serrated edges cut the heart as we break open to the place inside which is unbreakable and whole while learning to sing.
Last May, on a Sunday morning much like this one, we had a question box service. Those who were gathered submitted questions, and I did my best to answer or at least respond to them during the sermon time. There were a lot of good questions. And there is one that I have been thinking about ever since that I think speaks to a reality that so many of us are grappling with right now. It read, "Do you ever feel overwhelmed with a feeling of existential dread? Sometimes, not all the time." And then there was a smiley face. "Gratitude helps." So I've kept that slip of paper close these past months, noticing my own moments of overwhelming existential dread and feeling less alone because someone else feels it too. This feeling of overwhelming dread might be the central challenge for us in this time. This feeling, or this time of climate change and climate strikes, political outrage after outrage after outrage, senseless violence after senseless violence, and personal heartaches that just come one after another. How are we called to live now? I don't have all the answers. There's a reason I didn't answer or respond to that question last May. I wanted months to ponder. I wish I had the answers. I have some of the answers, I think, and so I will share them with you today. First, when that dread or fear or overwhelm comes, we need to feel our feelings. We need to notice the fear of what my life and my children's lives may be. It's uncomfortable to do this. It's hard. A lot of us haven't developed the muscle to sit with that level of discomfort. Our culture doesn't teach us how to do this. It's so much easier to escape or numb ourselves to those feelings. So whether we numb ourselves with wine or social media, television or drugs, sugar or shopping, overscheduling and overcommitting so we are too busy to feel, or something else, it's an easy trap. One I fall into more often than I would like to admit. Many of you have heard me quote folk singer Ani DiFranco, who says, "Every tool is a weapon if you hold it right." And so all of these behaviors, all of the things we can use to help us get back into emotional balance, are both tools and weapons. They are tools when they create pleasure, deep pleasure, and connection to one another or to our sources of strength. And they are weapons when they create the separation and numbness and disconnection from our sources of strength, however we define them. And we define them in many different ways in this community. So notice what you turn to when the overwhelm creeps in. And is it helping you reconnect to what gives you strength? Or is it a way to numb yourself out of distress? For me, I know it's often easier to play a little video game or check in on the latest argument unfolding in some corner of Facebook or have some ice cream than it is to still myself enough to be present to the overwhelm, the dread, the existential fear that living now brings me. And this doesn't mean that I don't sometimes do all of these numbing things, because sometimes you just need to get through the day. But I'm working to do that less, because I know that numbing and keeping myself from feeling my feelings doesn't serve me or us in the long term. And we need to feel what we feel, because we don't get to selectively numb ourselves. There's no like checkbox where you can say, "I don't want to feel fear, but I still want to feel joy." Brené Brown is a research social worker and author, and she researches shame and vulnerability and leadership, and she's an important teacher to many of us here. And she says, you cannot selectively numb emotion. When we numb the hard feelings, we numb joy, we numb gratitude, and we numb happiness. And if there is to be a way through these times, we will need all of the joy and gratitude and happiness that we can find. So feel your feelings, especially when they are the overwhelming dread, despair, and fear. It's hard to do this. And when you do that, don't hold them too tightly. Another teacher of mine in recent months is the author Rebecca Solnit. She wrote a book called Hope in the Dark that I've, I think, quoted three times in the past 3 months from this pulpit. It's about having hope in times of uncertainty and recognizing that every moment is a time of uncertainty. So Solnit describes going on book tours and having her audience, mostly people on the political left, get angry with her for encouraging people to have hope. She writes, "The despairing were so deeply attached to their despair, so much so I came to refer to my project as stealing the teddy bear of despair from the loving arms of the left." I love that image, right? She continues, "What did despair give that particular sector of the left? It got them off the hook, for one thing. If the world is totally doomed, no matter what, little or nothing is demanded of you in response. You can go be bitter and idle on your sofa if you're already comfortable and safe." So we need to feel the despair and the dread and overwhelm. And we cannot turn it into the teddy bear that keeps us company as we don't do anything. It's a hard balance. Let me know when you figured this out. How do we keep the despair from becoming that cozy teddy bear? Again, I don't have all the answers, but there are some things I know. First, we need to find our teachers. Who are the resilient beings in your life? Look to your ancestors, both biological and spiritual. Molly Hausch Gordon, who wrote the second reading that Tim read so beautifully this morning, is the minister at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Columbia, Missouri. And her list of how to survive the end of the world was crafted among a group of UU ministers, because we're all preaching really similar sermons right now, unfortunately. So she writes, remember your ancestors and the things they survived. Find the resilience that is your birthright and the courage that made way for your life. All of our biological ancestors, all of them, going back as far as you can go, survived long enough to reproduce. And that is something. That is not a guarantee. What do you know about how your ancestors survived? What can they teach you about surviving now? I've been learning a lot about my great-grandmother, Alice. Alice was a woman who grew up on the prairie, who was a dressmaker and a farm wife, and who held her family together after they lost their farm in the Great Depression. She's a story of resilience that I hold close. She made children's clothes and quilts out of her husband's threadbare suits or any other scrap of clothing she could find. In the midst of the Depression, she and her family arrived in a new community following a job for her husband that didn't pan out as well as they had hoped. It was too late for planting season, and they had very little money. Her family survived that winter because their new neighbors, mostly Mormons, shared their harvest with the new Methodist family in town, my ancestors. And after that, her generosity was extravagant. In my own times of uncertainty and challenge, I remember her. I know that I can create and adapt and give and receive generously in challenging times. I exist quite literally because people welcomed the new, different family in town and made sure that they were fed. This is not an exceptional story. We all have stories of survival in us. So who are your ancestors? What do they have to teach you about living through times of uncertainty and fear, dread, and despair? And our ancestors, of course, are not only our biological family. There's many, many lines, many lineages that we can claim. And as Unitarian Universalists, we are the descendants of people who survived challenging times, who held fast to their deepest commitments despite painful consequences. Our Unitarian ancestors believed that revelation is not sealed, which means that that truth was not dictated once forever, but is always making itself known, and that we are required to change our beliefs as our understandings of truth, as the latest teachings of science, call us into new ways of knowing. So their commitment to the right to change one's mind religiously sometimes led to martyrdom and suffering and death. But the ideas have survived, and we carry them forward. And that is a powerful legacy to have inherited, a powerful testimony of adaptation, learning, and commitment to the truth. So let that guide us now, especially as we face our climate crisis. Our understandings need to shift as science discovers new truths, and we are carrying on that legacy as we do that. the other half of our often cumbersome name as a religious tradition points to our universalist spiritual ancestors. They were committed to the idea that everyone is worthy of love, that everyone is ultimately reconciled to the love they would call God that surrounds us always. Everyone has inherent worth, no exceptions. So let that guide us too, and let us call on those stories of those ancestors, especially in this time of polarization, when so many seem so eager to discount those who don't agree with them as less than human or unworthy of love and care. Our ancestors show us another way, rooted in the idea that we all have inherent worth and dignity, no exceptions, no matter what. And of course, in this time, as we look for our teachers of resilience and survival and facing the overwhelm and continuing to act, our best teachers could be the people who have been living with despair and dread and fear much longer than us. Most of us here are white. Not all of us are. Most of us here have some degree of financial security. That's not true for all of us. And many of us benefit from other forms of privilege, whether that's rooted in our level of education or our sexuality, our gender identity, currently being able-bodied. And I have been learning from so many of my friends and neighbors and fellow congregants who don't share my particular privileged identities that they know a lot more about bearing despair and overwhelm and finding resilience than I do. They've had to do it a lot longer than I have. So they are my teachers in this time. Molly Hausch-Gordon again writes, "Sit at the feet of your most vulnerable neighbors in your own most vulnerable places. They have the most to teach you about survival. Listen." So I encourage you to listen, knowing that listening in this way is subtle and needs to be rooted in relationship. One can't just walk up to someone with a different lived experience and demand to know how they keep going. Listening in this way might also mean witnessing the people who endure hardship and drawing some conclusions, or reading or listening to lectures, or otherwise finding the people who are offering their wisdom about survival and resilience in these times. And our teachers of resilience don't have to be human either. Look to the natural world. In the poem that gave this service its title, Kentucky poet Wendell Berry writes that in the moments of despair and fear, "I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things that do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. I rest in the grace of the world and am free." Perhaps you are one to lie down on the shore of a lake and remember to be present. Perhaps you find a rock that has survived millennia and reflect on what it knows of endurance. The book Emergent Strategy by Adrienne Marie Brown is another text I recommend for these times. It's a collection of essays and interviews and a few spells that encourage us to look to the natural world as a source of resilience and a source of strategies for making change. One of the natural teachers that is named in that book is the starfish. Someone interviewed in the book says, "From starfish, I have learned that if we keep our core intact, we can regenerate. We can fall apart, lose limbs and regrow them as long as we don't let anyone threaten that central disc's integrity. We can grow so many different arms depending on what kind of sea star we are. So reflecting on starfish and their ability to shed limbs and grow new ones helps me think about what is my core and what I might be willing to sacrifice in this time of great change. What are we willing to lose, to release, to let go? What is our central integrity that we must protect, and what might we need to shed in order to meet the challenges before us? I expect all of our answers to be different to these questions, and I invite you to reflect on them with me. How might we be like starfish? How might we metaphorically fall apart, lose limbs, and regrow them as we face what is before us? What new ways of being or doing do we get to grow? I don't have the answer, but I think this might be the question. The final teacher that I want to commend to you this morning is the oak tree, specifically the oak trees of the Gulf Coast. Poet Naima Penniman tells this story, also in Emergent Strategy. When Hurricane Katrina slammed into the Gulf Coast, almost everything lost its footing. Houses were detached from their foundations, trees and shrubbery were uprooted, signposts and vehicles floated down the rivers that became of the streets. But amidst the whipping winds and surging water, the oak tree held its ground. How? Instead of digging its roots deep and solitary into the earth, the oak tree grows its roots wide and interlocks with other oak trees in the surrounding area. And you can't bring down 100 oak trees bound beneath the soil. She continues, how do we survive the unnatural disasters of climate change, environmental injustice, over-policing, mass imprisonment, militarization, economic inequality, corporate globalization and displacement? We must connect in the underground. In this way, we shall survive. So finding our teachers of resilience, our examples of surviving the overwhelm, dread, despair, and fear, is one of the ways that we knit our metaphorical roots together to survive the hurricanes that are part of life, especially in this time. For trees, binding roots together might be instinct, the natural consequence of growth. For us, it takes effort and intention. We knit our metaphorical roots together and become stronger by facing our emotions honestly and not numbing ourselves to them, by practicing generosity, by telling our stories to ourselves and one another, and by finding the beings, human and otherwise, that can teach us about survival and resilience. None of this is easy work. If it was, we would have done it already. But it might just be the way we make it through. We make it through this time when overwhelm and dread, fear and uncertainty are our close companions. May it be so. May we make it so. And amen.